Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind. Graphic Audio presents Great American Westerns. Stories by Honoré Wilsey Morrow, Gene Williams, Max Brand, Cynthia Hasselhoff, T.T. Flynn, Peter Dawson, Richard S. Wheeler, C.K. Shaw, and Jane Candia Coleman. Narrated by Terence Aselford. With performances by Thomas Keegan, Bradley Smith, Danny Gavigan, Eric Messner, Joe Brack, Nanette Savard, Casey Platt, Dylan Lynch, Richard Rowan, Kimberly Gilbert, Tim Carlin, Colleen Delaney, Michael Glenn, Ken Jackson, James Konacek, Tim Pabone, Catherine Aselford, Christopher Graybill, Ted Stoddard, Patrick Busink, Yasmin Toison, Gary Tells, Michael John Casey, David Coyne, James Keegan, Ren Casey, and Mort Shelby. Great American Westerns, Volume 2. Breaking the Blue Roan by Honoré Wilsey Morrow. John Hardy's father moved from Montana to a homestead in Wyoming in John's first year. The homestead prospered, and when Bill Hardy died in John's 25th year, he left his son 5,000 head of Herefords and 100 or so of range horses. At 35, John remained a bachelor, a man of magnificent physique, best known for his taciturnity, his slowness, and his superb horsemanship. In spite of his many acres and his herds, John did not appeal to the women of Lost Trail. Some of them called him too lazy to make love. Some of them said a man soft with horses like John never made a successful lover. Others that John was too stupid to find a wife. All of which merely goes to prove Lost Trail women suffered from poor judgment in men. Quite unknown to the rest of the valley, John was in love, deeply, passionately in love, and had been ever since the new schoolmarm came to the log schoolhouse on the mountainside. Not that Edith Archer, the schoolmarm, guessed this fact. She would probably have said that one of the Lost Trail girls bred to the saddle and to the bitter, hard work of the ranch would be John's choice. At least she would have said this the first few months of her stay in Lost Trail. What she really said later is part of this story. Edith Archer arrived in Lost Trail, slender and gray-eyed, with masses of chestnut hair wrapped around a finely shaped head. Her eyes large and deeply set and grave, her mouth richly curved and wistful, most thought her beautiful. Her low voice sounded as an anomaly in Lost Trail, where women spoke shrilly and men spoke softly. She took up residence at Lost Trail in September. By May, the 7,000 feet of elevation at which the valley sat ceased to make her pant at the slightest exertion. She could stick on a well-broken horse, and she had tooled the Lost Trail school along at a pace unprecedented in the annals of that happy-go-lucky assemblage. By May, most of the eligible young riders of Lost Trail had offered themselves to Edith and been refused, all but John Hardy and Dick Holton. John, because he didn't want to add the pain of a refusal to his general sense of unfitness. Dick, because for all he was in love with Edith, he had plans afoot that did not harmonize with marriage. Edith herself looked on marriage as bondage, which she had not the slightest desire to enter. As John loped past the schoolhouse late one May afternoon, Edith hailed him.
Oh, Mr. Hardy, would you mind calling for my mail, too?
John took a fair bit of riding at Pete's store and post office when he asked for her mail. More than a few fellas, Archer's exes, they called themselves, got a greenish look about them as he carried her letters away. When he returned to the schoolyard, he found Edith sitting on the log doorstep of the schoolhouse.
Were you ever allowed to gallop alone on the enemy when you were in France, Mr. Hardy?
I was put into the infantry.
They didn't want you to scare the Germans to death, of course.
John's bigness came of bone and sinew. He jumped from the saddle without touching the stirrups, pulled off his hat, and handed Edith her mail. She looked up at him, still smiling.
Little Charlie Baines is watering my horse for me. Will you rest a bit, or must you go on?
John sat down on the log beside the schoolmarm, who did not open her letters, but sat waiting for the big rider to speak. Her eyes swept the powerful lines beneath the chaps and the soft silk shirt, then paused on the stern modeling of his mouth and chin. Still, John didn't speak. His eyes lifted from the green-budding alfalfa in the valley to the menacing black saw edge of the Deadfire Range.
Well, I hate to leave it all.
When do you go?
I thought I'd wait for the 4th of July rodeo. Shall you ride?
John nodded.
Mr. Lawson said he was going to ask you to come to help him with the Blue Roan tomorrow.
Yes, I'll be up there, I guess.
Oh, it must be a wonderful thing to have the skill with horses that you have.
You wouldn't think so if you'd been brought up in Lost Trail, and if you'd been brought up in Lost Trail, you'd have been spoiled.
Spoiled? My word, man, what was there to spoil? If I'd been bred in this valley, I might have been wild and full of fight like the Blue Roan, but I'd have been really worthwhile. As it is, I'm just a soft easterner.
The Blue Roan wasn't bred in this valley. She's a wild horse Hank roped up in Many Eagles a while back. And I can't see how anyone would want you to be bred in this rough, godforsaken spot.
Don't you like it?
Of course. But I'm rough and godforsaken like the country. Nobody like you could put up with it for very long.
The schoolmarm stared at the rancher curiously.
Sometimes I get tired of it.
What could you desire more than you have?
Well, even a rider likes something that's beautiful and fine in his life once in a while. The older I get, the more I realize that the folks that marry just on cattle and like cattle don't know anything at all about what there might be in love. And there might be something that these Lost Trail folks don't realize exists, you know?
If Edith felt surprised, she didn't show it. For long months, she had tried to tempt John Hardy to share with her what thoughts lay behind the rugged dignity of his quiet face. And she was not going to stop the unexpected confidence by a show of amazement.
There should be the same beauty and love here that there is about those ranges yonder. Just as subtle and just as enduring. But one would never expect to find it here. Or anywhere else.
Before John could continue, small Charlie appeared with a little bay horse.
Shall I help you?
If you don't mind. Oh!
John did not offer his knee. Instead, he stepped up on the log, put his great hands around Edith's waist, and swung her into the saddle as if she were a child.
We'll see you at the ranch tomorrow then, Mr. Hardy?
Yes, I'll be along.
Edith boarded with the Lawsons at the north end of the valley. Their ranch of 1,000 acres straddled Lost Trail Creek, which tumbled like a liquid green opal past the corrals and down the alfalfa fields. The Lawsons' little log cabin was set in a grove of quivering aspens within easy access of the creek. There was no fence about the house. Cattle, horses, dogs, cats, and chickens inhabited the very doorstep amid a litter of saddles, harness, spurs, lariat ropes, and nosebags. When John Hardy rode up the next morning at about 11 o'clock, he saw two or three riders sitting on the fence. Mrs. Lawson occupied the hay wagon, and Edith perched on the top bar of the corral gate, hugging the post. Hank Lawson stood in the corral, holding a Blue Roan mare by a lariat round her neck. John tied Nellie to the hay rack. Mame Lawson waved.
You're just in time, John. She's thrown the hull of them. She just dumped Dick, and they had to rope her to keep her from climbing the fence.
John threw his long legs over the fence beside the other riders. Hank Lawson, owner of the ranch and the Blue Roan, and also married to Mame, stood in the middle of the corral with an anxious hold on the roan's hackamore.
She's sure a bird. But ain't she a beauty? Got some Hambletonian in her and some Morgan by her head.
From his perch on the fence, Hank's friend Pink Marshall couldn't resist.
Gord, Hank, you'll be claiming Clydesdale for her yet, just because her mane's curly. She's just the orneriest unbroke mare in Lost Trail. Half-engine pony and the other half wildcat.
John, hunched on the topmost rail, looked from the panting horse to Edith, and from Edith to the great white crest of Eagle's Peak, which brooded with appalling intimacy over the Lawson Ranch, then back to the mare. She was about 15 hands high, a spotless blue roan in color, with the magnificent mane and tail that the open winter range produces. She had the round, strong back and barrel so desirable in the mountains, small feet and the lean, wiry neck that spelled ancestry, real if remote. Her breast was foam-flecked.
Hard to mount?
Easy as a bolt of lightning. Look at the she-hellion with her tail and neck as limp as a rag doll. Wouldn't you think she was stuffed with sawdust? Go to it, John. I hold the record to date. I stayed with her just 6 minutes. Hank's gonna enter her down at Cheyenne Frontier Day as the great unbroke. I'd like to see one of those champions tackle her.
John pulled off his coat and vest and dropped them across the fence. He drew his broad rider's belt tighter, adjusted his spurs, and put on his gloves again.
Who saddled her?
All of us. Everything's okay. A new cinch and hackamore, but I warn you, she got the makings of a killer in her.
What's the idea of breaking her, poor thing? I've a strange sort of sympathy for her. You have 100 horses, Mr. Lawson.
Lawson looked from Edith's puzzled eyes to the row of grinning riders.
Well, she's got to be broke, ain't she?
I don't see why. You've lots of horses you never break.
Well, yes, but she's a beauty, and she's got to be broke. Come on, John.
John put his hand on the reins. The roan jerked her head high in the air. Lawson now shortened the lariat till he reached the animal's head. Then, with the mare backing and plunging violently, he loosened the noose and slipped the rope.
You get on the fence, Hank, and don't make any more noise than you naturally feel you have to.
Ouch!
John had no quirt. With one hand gripping the reins firmly, the horse tried to rear, and the man jumped aside to avoid her forehooves. Then he began to work with her.
Oh, so, beauty, so. Why worry? Life is always like this. Better be broke by a man than by a mountain lion on the range. So, that's no way to act. Whoa!
John tried to put his left hand, which held the reins, on the pommel. Edith, sitting on the gate, tried not to miss a word of the monologue.
Wait, beauty, whoa! You don't know what you've been missing. The best fun in life for a horse or man is in the saddle. Calm now. Nobody's gonna hit you over the head while I'm around.
Suddenly, and without touching the stirrups, John was in the saddle. The mare dropped her head. John established his feet quickly in the stirrups. She drew her legs under her belly, her tail flattened between her hind legs, and her ears laid back on her neck. She quivered. Great muscles of the shoulders knotted. As the battle continued to rage, Edith turned to Pink Marshall.
Will she kill him?
Shucks! Nobody hardly ever gets killed by horses out in this country. You gotta hand it to old John. 16 minutes and she ain't budged him.
Edith's eyes swept the glowing beauty of the range, then dropped back to the blue roan, the rider whose soft silk shirt was wet with sweat. Again and again, the mare, her eyes mad with fear and anger, jumped for the sun and fell back to her side. Through rolls, bucks, and jumps, John stayed on the roan.
52 minutes and he ain't pulled leather yet. But he might as well quit. I'll send her down to Cheyenne.
Don't engage space quite yet. Watch this.
The panting horse stood in the middle of the corral. John lifted the reins high above her neck and drove the rowels home. The blue roan broke into a gentle trot and slowly circled the corral until John brought her to pause and carefully and painfully dismounted.
Oh, he sure grips him.
You'll note that she's spur and not quirt broke.
Mame Lawson swung a haymaker at the air in front of her.
Whew! I ain't seen nothing better. Not even on Frontier Day, except when Annie Rice, the cowgirl, got killed.
John walked over to the fence and looked up at Edith. She smiled a little unevenly.
I'm glad you won, but I'm sorry for the blue roan.
I didn't hurt her. Not near as much as she hurt me. Maybe she'll live to thank me.
John's smile haunted Edith for hours. The other riders sidled over to the haystack for some of Mame's coffee.
I'd like to ride the blue roan.
You let her alone till she's well broke. And I don't think Lawson can ladybreak her. Maybe he'll let me do it for him.
Riding makes me sleep. For a year before I came to Lost Trail, I hadn't had a real night's sleep.
And what was the trouble?
Too much teaching and other things.
Ah, a man?
I've liked many men, but I certainly never would admit that one of them had given me insomnia. And I don't think I'd walk in my sleep or dream strange dreams if I had the skill and courage to fight with the roan every day.
You let her alone. Even if you have liked many men, that doesn't teach you to control a wild horse.
Edith gave him a quick, inscrutable little smile.
Come and get some coffee.
John returned the smile and followed her to the hay rack. Hank turned to John.
Well, Johnny, what are you going to charge me for breaking the beauty?
You mean you want me to take her home and get her in saddle shape?
I sure don't. She's good enough for me to start with right now.
You let me take her home and I'll ladybreak her for you for nothing.
Dick Holton looked sideways at John.
What's that for? Hank or the schoolmarm?
Both.
Don't you do it, Hank. It would be a shame to have a mare like that lady broke. And don't you think that John's taking the freedom out of her?
The others turned to follow Dick's gaze. The blue roan stood on the far side of the corral, her head resting on the top bar of the gate. There was something dejected in the droop of the beautiful blue-brown body, but something unquestionably spirited in the lift of the head toward the eternal hills. Edith looked from the blue roan to John and from John to Dick.
I got a good horse that's lady broke that I'd admire to give you, Miss Archer.
No thanks. The blue roan or nothing.
Oh, she'll be running away the first chance she gets. Me? I hope she does.
The other riders cast troubled looks toward Dick as he mounted his horse and left. The glorious moon that night kept the creatures in the valley up baying and singing. Between the animal choir and his thoughts of Edith, John couldn't sleep. The creatures seemed indescribably melancholy to John. He was glad when, with the coming of the dawn, the far calls ceased. He slept. A knock at his door around noon got John jerking on his trousers to answer the summons. Pink Marshall and Art Brown stood in the yard waiting for him.
Hank sent word for us to come up. Schoolmarm seems to have walked off somewhere last night.
Before he had finished speaking, John was throwing the saddle on Nellie, and the three trotted out of the yard.
When did they miss her?
Pink looked at his watch.
Not an hour ago. Hank phoned me then. They said they always let her lie late on Sunday. She was such a poor sleeper. The Mame tries to keep the house quiet, but when they went to call her for dinner, she wasn't there. At first, they just thought she'd slipped out for a stroll without their noticing her. Then Mame sees she hadn't dressed, just gone out in her nightgown and slippers.
Should we stop by for Dick?
He went to Cheyenne last night.
Art shook his head.
Her nerves must be in awful shape. How do you suppose Easterners get that away? Who ever heard of a woman in Lost Trail having insomnia?
Mame Lawson said Edith told her ever since she was a child, whenever anything disturbed her in the daytime, she was apt to walk in her sleep at night.
She better ought to settle down here. She takes to this life just fine.
And there's another strange thing. The blue roan got away last night.
No one spoke again until they drew rein at the Lawsons' door. There they set their search plan and headed out. All day long they scoured the country in circles of ever-widening circumference. After sundown, before the moon rose, John returned to his house for a fresh horse and the equipment for living on the trail for a day or two. His arrangements made, he threw himself down to wait for the moonlight. And it seemed to him that he fell into a light doze and dreamed of Edith.
John! Help me! John! Help me!
I'm going plumb crazy. First time I've dreamed of her. Oh, God knows she hasn't been out of my thoughts since she came here.
He searched by moonlight, carrying with him a little piece of her bathrobe found on a nail in the Lawson's corral, and some of her clothes. According to Mame, the robe was one of those Chinese things you see in the store windows at Salt Lake. At the foot of Eagle Mountain, he pulled up while he thought rapidly. He could recall a canyon weathered out of the pink sandstone that composed the chaos which lay between the Deadfire Range and many eagles, but it was so inaccessible it seemed to him highly improbable Edith could have come upon it. Yet even as he sat debating with his common sense, he seemed to hear the voice of his dream.
John! Oh, John, help me!
John turned his horse Pete and Miss Lucky the pack horse into the Many Eagles trail. He knew he was a fool. He knew that Edith must have wakened long before she'd come this far, even if this had been her direction. Yet the potency of the dream overcame every protest advanced by his lifelong experience in the hills. Hour after hour, he pushed toward the chaotic valley beyond Many Eagles. It was after midnight when the trail around a mountainside opened into a canyon with sheer sides, remotely edged by pines. The sides themselves were barren, but in the moonlight they were of a brilliancy of color that was almost unbelievable. John threaded his way carefully among the many rock heaps on the floor of the canyon, stopping to rest the animals at frequent intervals. The canyon sat at an elevation over 8,000 feet, and the horses labored. In one of those intervals, he heard the dull, thudding tramp of an unshod horse. Before he could start his small cavalcade on to meet the sound, a figure in a blue robe stumbled into view. It was Edith, and she was leading the blue roan. When she saw John, she stopped.
Oh, John! John Hardy!
John strode toward her.
Here I am, Miss Archer. What in heaven's name has happened?
I shot him. I had to.
Shot whom? Are you hurt?
John took the lead rope from her, and she clung to his arm.
No, only bruised. Don't speak to me for a minute. I'm trying so hard not to make a fool of myself.
John stood patiently for a moment.
Suppose you don't try to talk at all until you get into the warm things I got on Miss Lucky's saddle for you. You put them on while I go around the rocks here and make us a little camp.
Edith nodded, and John, after giving her the bundle of clothing, proceeded to make a great fire of sagebrush and scrub cedar. By the time the fire was going well, Edith appeared around the rocks in her riding suit, her face white and tense.
Will you give me a drink of water?
John held his canteen to her lips.
Now, I'll put the coffee on to boil and get out the sandwiches Auntie Farmer fixed for me. Then you can tell me about it when you aren't so faint and cold.
I must tell you now.
Let me put the coffee pot on, and then you can go ahead. Sit down here out of the smoke.
I didn't get to sleep quickly Saturday night. And when I did, I had troubled dreams. I kept dreaming of the blue roan, and that both you and she were hurt. I thought I'd better go to your rescue, and in my dream, I went out to the corral, roped the blue roan, and led her away. She was very hard to lead, and she kept pulling me down, and finally, one specially hard fall wakened me. I was so cold and with my slippers all wet with dew. And I was so out of breath that I lay down under a cedar tree. While I was huddled there, I heard horses coming. I didn't know who it might be or whether it was just strays, so I didn't call. And then Dick Holton rode by with three horses, and one of them was the blue roan.
The blue roan? Did you really let her out? I know you couldn't have roped her.
I must have let her out. I always did dislike him. And he's the last man in Lost Trail I'd have wanted to rescue me. But I wasn't going to let him get away with that beautiful horse, especially as I felt guilty about her. So after he had gone by, I followed him. I thought maybe he'd put her somewhere for safekeeping, and then I could tell Mr. Lawson.
And you followed him? Far?
I don't know how far. It seemed a long time. And then I fell, and like a great baby, I cried out, and he heard me and came back. I was sitting against the rock I'd slipped off of, and he just stood and looked at me. I said,
"Where are you going with the Blue Roan?" And he said, "I'm going to put her where your friend Hardy will never glom his big hands on her. She was wandering loose, and she's mine now." And then I saw that he'd been drinking heavily, and I told him I'd been walking in my sleep, and that if he'd tell me the way home, I'd be grateful. Then he laughed, and he said, "God, lots of girls have been fond of me, but none of them ever followed me this way." And he stooped over me, and I struck him as hard as I could. And he struck me back and tried to pick me up and kiss me. And he said, "I'll fix it so you'll never want to tell anyone in Lost Trail you've seen me." I fought him and managed to get his six-shooter out of his belt, and I pressed it against him and pulled the trigger. And he dropped and rolled over dead. Then I went and got the Blue Roan's lead rope and started for what I thought was home, and I got lost, and I thought you'd never come."
John stood staring at her, cold sweat on his brow.
"How do you know he's dead? Did you examine him? Where'd the bullet go?"
I don't know where it went. I couldn't have touched him, could I? I wasn't trying to run away. I am going to give myself up to the sheriff as soon as I get back."
"Give yourself up? Nothing. If you hadn't shot him, Lost Trail would have made a sieve of him. No one can get away with manhandling a woman or horse stealing on these ranges, even if he is a drunk. Maybe you didn't kill him."
He poured her a cup of coffee and offered her a couple of sandwiches.
"Could you sleep a little?"
Sleep? No. How could I sleep with his awful voice in my ears?
"Have you any idea where you were when it happened?"
"No."
"Was there any landmark you could describe? The moon was still high?"
"The moon was just setting. There was a spring with a big tree growing above it."
"Blue Aspen Spring. Edith, you swung clear around the mountain and aren't 2 miles from it now. We can get to it by a shortcut up the wall yonder."
"Get to it? Do I have to see him again?"
"Edith, I want to see whether you really killed him or not before we report to Lost Trail. You can stay here."
"No. I told you I couldn't sleep with his voice in my ears."
"Will you do something for me? Won't you lie down on my blanket here by the fire and rest with your eyes closed until dawn?"
"I know you despise me, but I don't dare close my eyes unless you promise to sit by me."
"I promise."
Edith started and jumped at once to her feet. Then she stared at John while recollection awoke.
"I'm ready to start."
"The sun will be here in a few minutes."
Swiftly, the dawn pricked out the fronded tops of the pines far above them. Faintly above the farthest pines rose the gigantic white outline of the Indian Range, moment by moment growing more vividly colorful until its splendor paled the prismatic tints of the canyon. They watched the mighty day arrive in silence. When the sun was free of the pines, John turned to the horses.
"These poor brutes are thirsty. Did you water the Blue Roan yesterday?"
"Yes, in the afternoon at a little muddy spring. She grazed there, too."
"Did you have any trouble leading her?"
"No. Wasn't it strange?"
"Not so strange. Sometimes you find a horse that's like a good dog and recognizes a friend."
John stepped over to the roan.
"So, beauty?"
"Let me lead her. I do think a great deal of that horse."
"Yeah? One might not have suspected it. You mount Miss Lucky and I'll give you the roan's lead."
It was a short and not too arduous trip back to the Blue Aspen Spring. It came into view as they rounded the shoulder of the mountain. First they saw Dick's two cow ponies standing by the pool. Then they saw Dick lying by the water's edge. He raised his head at their approach.
"Where'd she get you?"
"Left side and right hip. I was drunk."
"Bleeding much?"
"Not if I don't move."
He lay staring at the sky, ghastly pale and worn.
"I'll leave you some grub. I'm going back and send the sheriff up here. I'm not going to trust myself to touch you, you can bet on that. If you aren't dead by the time he gets here, my advice is that you keep your mouth shut."
Dick's lips set in a grim line, but he said nothing. And so they watered the horses and rode away and left him. Edith didn't speak for some moments. The relief was at first more than she could voice, but she finally spoke after a mile of hard trail when John called a halt for breakfast.
It's like waking from a nightmare.
I know. I'm about as relieved as you are, but only for your sake. He deserved much more than he got.
They took breakfast on the side of a mountain facing west. Remotely below lay the Valley of Lost Trail. They sat waiting for the coffee to boil. Edith watched the red mists of Bear Mountain.
I wanted to kill him where he lay.
After all, he didn't harm me. And I did save the Blue Roan.
John looked at Edith with something finer than admiration in his blue eyes.
What are you going to tell the sheriff?
I'm going to tell him the truth.
You better let me say I shot him while I was taking the Blue Roan, and then I picked you up elsewhere.
Edith stared at his grim face, puzzled for a moment.
Oh, I see. But I'm not going to let you lie for me. Lies are very difficult. I never have met anyone I thought clever enough to lie. And what about the story Holton will tell?
I'll bet Dick tells nothing. And I'll bet he never stays in Lost Trail so long as I'm in it. And Lawson may shoot him up again for stealing the Blue Roan. He's good for a long stay in Rawlins if he gets well. And when he gets out of Rawlins, or before if I can get at him, I'm going to beat him up so bad his own mother won't know him. But what I've got to do now is to keep the he and she gossips of Lost Trail from banding your name about. Just leave the story to me, will you, Edith?
He sat down beside her, looking into her face with such a depth of earnestness that she couldn't help but agree to his request.
Yes, if it won't get you into trouble.
It won't. You haven't asked me how I came to be looking for you in such an unlikely spot. We were all hunting for you from yesterday noon on. At dusk, I went home for fresh horses, and I took a nap while I was waiting for the moon to rise. I dreamed that I saw you in the Pink Canyon in that blue Chinese thing, and that you were calling to me. Did you really call to me?
Yes.
Why? Did you call to the others? Hank and Pink and Art? Do you remember that talk we had at the schoolhouse Friday afternoon? And I said that a man, even a rider, liked something beautiful and fine in his life once in a while. What did you think when I said that?
I thought how little the average woman really knows what goes on inside a man's mind. And I've been thinking that ever since. You see, any woman always thinks she's more refined, has more delicate perceptions than any man.
Lots of them have. Me, I wouldn't know a delicate perception if I met one. Is that all you thought?
No. I thought that most women were stupid egoists, me among them.
I'm not sure what one of those critters is, but I know you aren't one. What did you really think about what I said, Edith?
Well, I thought how blind you were not to see the enchanting beauty of the Lost Trail country. And I thought, as I'd thought so many times before, how strange it was that all of Lost Trail's conversation was in sordid terms of cattle raising, when some of it might quite normally be in terms of the most soul-stirring scenery that ever intrigued a poor, futile Easterner.
John stared at Bear Mountain and the glory of the brilliant clouds beyond it as if he never before had seen them.
All my life, I've been looking for beauty. Till I found you.
Me? I'm just a tired Easterner with no nerve.
Do you remember that I said that maybe there might be something pretty fine about love that we Lost Trail folks didn't know existed? And you answered that there ought to be something as fine here in love as there was in the beauty of these ranges. Edith, will you tell me what love means to you?
I thought I knew when I was in my teens. But as I've grown older, I've discovered that what I thought was love could never endure. Now I know that no matter what anyone says to the contrary, the love that endures is a thing of the mind, intangible and permanent, and based on the irresistible attraction of soul to soul, and not of body to body.
If your mind, or soul, or whatever it was, called across the mountains to us yesterday, and only I heard and answered, might it mean that I felt this intangible... Oh, Edith, help me. I would never have the courage to say this much if you hadn't called to me in my dream.
I called only to you.
Why?
When I saw you break the blue roan with gentleness, I knew that I could care for you. But I've always hated the thought of marriage. But now, after this experience... John, I guess you've broken me with gentleness, too.
God, Edith, could that mean that you would want to marry me?
It might.
Do you think you know how much and how little a man like me could bring you?
I know that you are fine and simple and beautiful, like your great hills, and that your mind's ear heard me call in my deep need.
Brother Shotgun by Gene Williams. His name was still Johnny Shadoin when he hitched his gray nag in front of the two-story frame building. It was the only house in this town that both showed a light and looked as if it might have room for a stranger. A day's ride in the raw March wind made his bad leg so stiff it didn't want to hold him up.
Oh, blessed godforsaken knee. You couldn't stop bothering me for a minute, could you?
He stamped till the blood came alive beneath the knee a mini-ball had smashed, and went on to the house. It wasn't till he'd climbed the steps that he could make out the lettering on an old card tacked to the door. Room and board. Inquire within. The board probably wouldn't amount to much. The way this part of West Virginia had been raided and counter-raided in the war. But as far as Johnny was concerned, he wouldn't enjoy a man's meal anyway till he was settled down to a rib of freshly killed buffalo. Buffalo, a sea lion on the plains, huge-shouldered, small-flanked, with enormous heads bent to crop the sweet curled grass. How many nights in camp with the 8th Kansas had he chewed on cornbread and cowpeas and closed his eyes, trying, if only for a flash, to see the herd and sniff the wind with them? The Reb Miniball put an end to that. Johnny earned a stake working in a coal mine. They were glad to get even kids and cripples this fourth year of the war, but his soldiering days were finished. Now he was going home. Johnny's chapped knuckles cracked against the splintered door.
Sounds as if all the boarders have 10 kids apiece.
Johnny stood looking at more children than he'd seen since he ran away from home and his own 10 brothers and sisters 40 years ago. Or at least it seemed that way. The boy in the door was red-headed. Above his blazing thatch leaned a black-eyed girl with the copper skin of an Indian. A blonde baby had pushed under the boy's arm and was staring up at Johnny with a finger in her mouth. Behind these three, others crowded, all ages, all sizes. Johnny, in spite of an addiction to minding his own business, wondered what the parents of this bunch could look like. He was a mixture himself, with a French-Spanish father, an Irish-Cherokee mother, but at least he and his 10 siblings all possessed black hair and eyes. Anyway, they used to have. His hair was streaking now, and he guessed his 2 older brothers would be white-headed, if they were still alive. A woman approached through the group.
All right now, children, back to your work. Supper won't fix itself.
She looked at Johnny half-smilingly, half-questioningly, and he saw that her eyes were the gray-silver of the underside of a cottonwood leaf. She had funny-colored hair, too. It reminded Johnny of the shine of yellow moonlight off an aspen, almost white but warmed with gold. Johnny had lived with Indians and didn't lump shadings into a list as white men did. He took off his hat.
I wonder, ma'am, if I could put up here for a day or two?
Quite frankly, she looked him over. He was in his buckskins. There was no way for her to know which army, if any, he had fought for. Was she for the Union, or did she believe in the Confederacy, as many people did in the young state of West Virginia?
Can you pay in greenbacks?
Johnny blinked. With Yankee money almost 10 times as valuable as Confederate, that was a sound question. Yet, well, he had her mixed up with moonlight and cottonwoods in his mind.
I can pay greenbacks.
She flushed. Her eyes flickered down a second before they came back to his.
If my husband's alive, he's in a Yank prison. But it takes money, real money, to buy shoes and food. Come on in, mister. We've just sat down to the table.
Johnny wondered at all the kids. The Indian-looking girl was in her teens. The woman with the gray eyes could not possibly be the mother of all the others. But if you don't ask questions, folks will tell you more than if you do, Johnny believed. So he bowed.
I'll join you directly, ma'am. But first I have to take care of my horse. Is there any hay in that stable out back?
There hasn't been for the past 3 years. But my neighbor, Eli Streaker, who sells me milk, keeps cows. I don't imagine he'd mind selling you some of their hay.
She turned to the red-headed boy.
Timmy, run over to Mr. Streaker and ask him if he'll fork some hay over in the lot for this gentleman's horse, please.
The boy ducked past Johnny, making for the house to the right, and the woman's lips curved in either amusement or contempt.
No use asking Eli to give anything. I pay for milk and get Blue John. You can come in the back way when your horse is tended to.
Johnny unhitched the gray and rode it around to the fenced lot surrounding the stable. The stocky red-faced man was already levering a pitchfork of hay over into the lot. Johnny met his curious stare.
I guess you're Streaker.
You guessed right.
Streaker twitched up another forkful, making sure all the clinging wisps fell off before he tossed the central mass over.
Dang raiders burned off most of my field last fall. I hardly had enough to help my own stock through the winter. Afraid I'm going to have to charge you a Yank dollar for this fodder.
Johnny lifted off his cobbled saddle and rubbed the gray's sweaty back and withers with the saddle blanket. It was an old horse with its teeth worn off smooth from years of grinding, but it was about the only four-legged critter Johnny could find after the surgeon decided Johnny was through soldiering. At first, remembering fast Indian ponies, untiring hounders of the buffalo, Johnny grew wild at this beast's shambling gait. But days before he reached the mine where he worked out his stake, his impatience turned into a feeling of kinship. Johnny was getting old, too. Some days he felt nearer 70 than 50.
I want just one more hunt. One more season. I'm much obliged for the fodder, mister. I guess I'll go up to the house and get me some food, too.
Better hurry, or the orphanage will have gobbled it all.
Orphanage?
Johnny removed his kit, took his shotgun and flute from his saddle, and headed into the kitchen. He wondered if the kids and Luann might like to hear him play. He would kind of like to do that, leave them a song before he went west to the buffalo. The rich smell of stew hit him altogether as he stepped into the kitchen. The stew was tasty, even though it was short on meat, and there was pan bread. Except for the three youngest children, none of them over two, everyone drank sassafras tea. Johnny had dreamed about coffee, but sassafras tea was better than some of the roasted acorn brew you got nowadays. Johnny squinted at the milk in the three babies' cups. It was thin, a transparent blue around the edges. He looked to Luann, who had properly introduced herself now as Mrs. Benton.
Ma'am, that milk sure looks as if it's been skimmed. Good cow's milk is bad enough, but that's sickening.
Eli has the only cow's milk left in town. He scrapes off the cream and sells it to people who can afford it. Anyway, what do you mean good cow's milk is bad enough?
Well, goat's milk is way ahead, ma'am. What can you expect from folks who eat hogs and sheep and chickens, who drink milk from critters that are so dumb they have to be fed and sheltered through the winter? It stands to reason that what you eat makes up your body. If you eat helpless, stupid critters, it'll affect your nature, too.
I think we're safe, Mr. Shadoin. Raiders have pretty well gotten off with all those animals. The meat in our stew was from a squirrel Timmy killed today with his slingshot.
Oh, squirrel's good meat. They're smart creatures. They store up food against the winter and live free in the woods.
Timmy glowed as Johnny nodded at him. The boy listened with his thin face pushed forward as Johnny went on.
A man who lives on wild game has to be quick and silent and has to depend on himself. He eats venison from swift deer and the tongues of buffalo who can scent a storm coming. Bear makes him strong, and he gets speed from the antelope and cunning from the sage rabbit. Freedom is in all of them, in their flesh, to thrive again in his flesh. The Comanches know this. They won't eat a turkey unless they're mighty hungry. They figure the meat'll give them chicken hearts, so they'll run from danger.
Timmy gave Johnny a dubious look with his sparkling blue eyes.
It's the truth, so help me. Goat's milk would be the thing for these youngsters, ma'am. It'll make them quick, sure-footed, and independent.
A smile teased at Luann's mouth. From the way it settled into natural lines, he could tell she'd never lost the grace of humor, in spite of the war and whatever happened to her husband and Streaker's Blue John.
Even if it wouldn't do all of those things, Mr. Shadoin, it'd be nourishment. But we might as well pine for strawberries and cream.
Seems that it costs less to buy a goat than to pay for milk.
I don't pay in cash. This was my parents' home, and Mother had some lovely furniture. A chair from France, a pianoforte, marble tables, that sort of thing. Eli's wife has always wanted to be a social leader. By owning my mother's things, she must hope to acquire Mother's character.
You traded that furniture for milk?
My parents are dead. They won't feel any grief over it. And you can't eat marble and wood.
Well, then why in Sam Hill didn't you trade the stuff for a cow?
Eli wouldn't agree to that. He says the cows furnish his living. No one in these days is going to trade a milk animal for furniture. Eli's wife, fortunately, wants the things enough to barter milk for them.
Johnny's mind hummed with questions. She ran a boarding house. Didn't she get any money from it? Where did the kids come from? Was she paid for their care? Would they be on her hands till they grew up? What would happen when the furniture was all traded off?
Well,
Johnny pushed back from the table. He was on his way home. This was none of his business. It was 3 years since he'd crept up on a buffalo, careful of the wind, wrapped in a hide. It was 3 years since he feasted on hump rib and lay in his blankets, settling into that deep, sensuous sleep that came as the rich flesh absorbed into his own blood and bone and muscle.
Just one more season, God. One good hunt.
It was the prayer that sustained him through the war and the mini-ball and the weeks in the coal mine. He hated the mine. It wasn't right that a mine should be down deep with no sun or wind. He didn't even want to be buried underground. When he thought of it, he hoped his bones would bleach out pale in the prairie grass, with the wind over them and the buffalo sniffing all around. A hand on his knee brought him back to West Virginia. The blonde baby girl had come up to him. Rosy mouth puckered over her finger, she watched him with calm interest.
Oh, it mustn't suck your finger.
Johnny lifted her onto his good knee.
It'll make your teeth grow crooked, Missy.
He saw her teeth. They were the shade of the transparent edge of Blue John. And her body, on his lap, seemed to weigh no more than a huddle of bones with the marrow gone.
Oh, hell, I ought to be able to get some kind of milk critter without blowing too much from the steak.
Of course, he wanted to buy a rifle. You had to get up too close with a shotgun, and many a hunter had been gored to death by the buffalo he was trying to kill. He'd need another horse, too. Even if the gray could stand the trip to the plains, it sure couldn't chase a herd.
But this little girl is so dang scrawny.
Timmy, suppose you dig into that tarp of mine and fetch me the flute. He played them songs and then let the Indian-looking girl try to make tunes while he sang Las Mañanitas, Green Grow the Rushes, oh, a chant his grandmother told him the Cherokees used to sing, and Frère Jacques to commemorate his French blood. But Timmy didn't know French.
Frère Shotgun, by grannies, I finally puzzled out a word from those Dormez-vous and Sona Le Matinas.
Hold on. It just means Brother John.
Well, your name is John, and you have a shotgun, too. This song's about you. Teach it to us.
Johnny did, while Luann smiled, and the black-eyed girl fluted. Even the baby girl caught the spirit and tried to sing. By the time Johnny went to bed, his name was Shotgun. Next morning, Johnny found out a lot. While he searched the town and visited a few farms, he let it be known he was boarding at Luann's. At that, nearly everyone he met burst out talking. Though he hadn't been able to abide the hypocritical concern of Eli Streaker, Johnny listened to these others. He had to know the answer to the questions that pestered him last night, the answer to Timmy and the baby and the Indian-looking girl and the other five children. Johnny talked mostly to old men and women. The providers, the earners, the young men were nearly all off to war, some for the Union and some for the South. Johnny saw that what Luann had said about raiders looting the country was true. Fields lay charred and black from being burned the summer before. Poverty crushed hard on nearly all the people, though a few had chickens or a cow or a pig. The Streakers were probably more prosperous than anyone in the little village. The store didn't have much merchandise. The owner had been killed by marauders, and his widow either couldn't or wouldn't stock even staples. Luxuries nested beside tallow and flour, and maybe what you wanted was there, and maybe not. The late owner's widow looked at Johnny as he bought candy sticks for the kids.
Luann's a fine woman, but she got in over her head taking in those youngsters. She can't buy food for them, much less shoes. Now her father, he was a doctor, left her the house but precious little cash. And the last she heard from her husband, he was a prisoner up north among those damn Yankees. So there she was, a girl with her parents dead and her husband gone to war. She decided to run a boarding house to bring in cash and to keep herself from sinking into self-pity and uselessness. And then, instead of paying guests, the place filled up with children. Timmy is a cousin of her husband's. The boy's stepfather gave him a savage beating, and Timmy ran away from him. Sarah, the dark girl, half-Injun, you know, lived off in the brush with her crazed father till his death a year ago. Luann, gathering berries in the woods, found the girl and brought her on home. Now, the blonde baby girl with the bluish teeth got left, along with an older sister, by a young couple who stopped at the boarding house last spring. The man and woman fussed a good deal, and they seemed worried. Turned out later that the man deserted from the army, and the sooner he could get to California, the better he'd like it. The woman seemed to love her children, but she was the kind who was plain crazy over her man, worthless and mean as he may be. Luann woke up one morning to hear the babies crying and to find the parents gone. The woman left a note and a little money she must have begged from the man. She said he wouldn't fool with the children and that she couldn't live without her husband. Luann was so kind. Wouldn't she take care of them and not let them know what kind of woman their mother had been? She'd try to send money, but she never has. And the four other children? A young farmer got killed in the war, and his wife sickened and died that same winter. The wife had no close kin, and her husband's folks wouldn't have the kids because their father fought on the Union side.
How has Luann managed to get by?
Well, she still gets an occasional boarder, though she surely finished what money her father left. She is a marvel with knitting and makes sweaters for a shop in Charleston. When they can, people help with what they have. A few eggs, cast-off clothing, fruit, vegetables. In summer, Luann and the children make a big garden. But it gets a little harder all the time to stretch her tiny resources. She's just doing the best she can, like all of us. Trying not to think about tomorrow, hoping the war will end and her husband will come on home.
Johnny pieced it together. He knew he had to get a goat. It took some doing and persuading, but he got one. Poorer by $15, which was $2 more than he'd been paid for a month's service in the army, Johnny led the goat home.
What have you brought home?
Look, ma'am, I want to go west and enjoy my hunt. I couldn't do it if I left these youngsters drinking that Blue John.
But you must not...
I'm crippled some. I'm not so young either. And I fought for the Union. On the opposite side from your husband. But you see, I'm a man. And a man's supposed to help feed children. Her eyes grew cold when he named his army.
Are you trying to salve your conscience?
He thought of the buffalo and the rest of his greenbacks. Maybe. But not the way you mean. Now, I never could relish the idea of any man's belonging to another. That's why I fought. She looked at him, and he looked back. And after a few moments, the tenseness left her muscles.
Well, you must take your board and room free, then, as long as you stay. I thank you for the goat, Shotgun.
Yeah, she'll be thrifty, ma'am, and she'll forage for herself. Her milk will make the baby strong and able to walk the edge of a cliff without falling over. And see, with this block, you can milk her and not have to bend to the ground. And I'll teach Timmy how to milk. What were a few more days of staying here? A horse could use the rest. But the few days became weeks. The stable, now it had an occupant, needed patching up. The fence needed to be mended. And a heavy storm caused leaks in the roof. Johnny spent several more dollars on these repairs. It seemed ornery not to attend to them when, while they didn't cost a lot, it was more money than Luann could scrape up. Tim could milk Nanny now as if he'd been doing it all his life, and Sarah was getting to play a smart tune on the flute. The kids could chant in Cherokee and sing snatches of French and Spanish. Johnny felt kind of pleased. It was a strange new feeling to know that once he left, and maybe even after he was dead, these kids would sing the songs he'd taught them and teach them to their children. Johnny passed through life as traceless as the wind, except perhaps for the bones of animals he killed and the ashes of his fires. He'd never left his trace on human hearts. Now he was leaving his songs in the minds of these children and rich milk in their stomachs. But it was a long way west, and the buffalo were sniffing some Kansas breeze. He was old. It was time to be going. His leg raised the devil with him now till he could hardly sleep at night, and his dreams were full of buffalo, spread out over the plains for miles. Johnny had started getting a funny feeling in his heart sometimes, as if a hand had lifted it and held it high and pulseless for a second before dropping it back in place. He wondered what would happen when the hand kept hold of it and didn't let it slip free. By October, his home stake was meager, but he guessed he'd better head west while he still had a hope of seeing the plains again. The gray horse had aged even in these months, and Johnny would have to ride slowly. The hand squeezed his heart. Sometimes it hurt so bad he thought the blood must be plumb wrung out. It bothered him especially when he climbed up or down from the saddle. Still, he felt glad to see how much better the children looked. Now he stood in front of the boarding house as he had done 7 months ago and watched Timmy chopping wood. Luann came over to Johnny.
I just don't know how to thank you, Shotgun. I was at the end of my rope last spring. But now you've given up all your savings. You did, didn't you? Or else you'd be chasing buffalo right now.
No, not quite. And I'm purely glad you're doing better. Don't the baby's teeth look nice? And she weighs a good bit, too. Don't you fret, Luann. I'm going home. Glad I could help you on my way. She wasn't the crying kind of woman, but the gray eyes were extra bright as she brought something from behind her back. She shook it out. Johnny got the scent of the rose leaves she must have put in to keep the bugs out, and then he stared at the long-sleeved, hooded red sweater. It was made with a black stripe at hip level and two others at the chest. It was knitted of warm yarn.
It's yours. And I made you a pair of black socks and a pair of red.
Blindly, Johnny took the sweater and pressed it with his calloused hands. No one, no woman, had made him such a garment, sewn with love, since he was a child.
Why, it's the fairest thing I ever saw.
When he went up to bed, he had to stop on the stairs twice as the hand clutched at his heart. But he held the red wool as if it was medicine, and the spells passed. Johnny was tired, but it was only for the gray's sake that he stayed at the house another 4 days. If you had time, this was good, singing with the kids, holding the baby, watching Luann looking brighter than he'd ever seen her. But Johnny had no time. Early one morning, he put his things in the tarp. The flute he held a minute and then laid aside. It had been his grandmother's. Now it would be for Sarah, who played it with love. With the instincts of the beasts he had lived among and hunted, he felt death in his flesh and bone. He felt it in his heart. If he wanted to see buffalo again, he must travel fast. This was the best time of the year, the time it would be when he got home, late in November. The calves would be fat and brown, and the insects would trouble the herd no more. It was the fat time of the buffalo, the rich time for hunters. He had to go. His tired horse, ruined knee, and bad heart wouldn't get any better. But if they were to carry him home, they had to do it now. On the fifth day, Johnny went down the stairs to find Luann crying in the kitchen. What's wrong, Luann?
Shotgun. My husband got exchanged, but he was so sick in prison. They're going to let him come home, but he hasn't any money and can't get paid, and you know they don't get good care in army hospitals. If I could go take care of him, bring him home, if he dies now.
Oh, there's no need for crying. I can lend you the money, Luann.
Your stake?
No, he lied. I can give you the money and still have enough to get out west.
Are you sure?
Of course I am. She put her face against his shoulder and cried. Here, you'd better get ready to go to your man. When she was gone on the train, Johnny gathered the older children. Now, Sarah, Timmy, you tell the others not to forget the Cherokee prayer or Green Grow the Rushes O or Las Mañanitas.
We'll remember Frere Jacques too, Shotgun. Send me some buffalo horns, will you?
Well, if I don't, you go out in a few years and you get your own. Sarah, mind you play that flute pretty. He mounted up with the hand on his heart clutching. He waved with his hat as he rode off, and the baby girl ran after him crying till Sarah caught her. He waved again at the edge of town and turned his face west. He and the sun traveled west together. But even though the sun had no clouds to cover it, today it seemed to shine less brightly than usual. Darkness seemed to be coming on early. He was in pain now. The hand gripped. But he sat as straight as he could and directed his intention and his will. If he was going west with all his desire, might not his spirit keep on after his body stopped? Might not his direction be so strong that the flesh couldn't stop it? If he fixed his mind on the buffalo, was that their drumming hoofs? Was that their dust obscuring the way in front of him? He strained to see, but the soft hills were falling away, slipping back. The hand lifted his heart, squeezed and squeezed and squeezed. He was slipping. He felt the earth. Then there was the sound of a great herd. He was running after them, west to the prairies, west to the hunt. The meat would be good and the sleep sweet.